And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of August 1st, 2019. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How you doing, Mariah?
I'm well. How are you, Ted?
Good. Cool, I hope, here in the hot northeast.
Oh. I tell you, I've been shaving my peak, though. I turn off my AC and go swimming from 3 to 7 on these hot days.
I think that we ought to try and get somebody from that organization to come on and tell us the story of Shave the Peak, because that would be an interesting story. Well, Mariah, so it turns out that, a useful topic for today is the concept of environmental justice, and that is coming to the fore because of the presidential campaign, sort of this nexus of the presidential campaign, the Green and the Green New Deal, where there's a lot of candidates running around talking about climate, have climate plans, you know, some better than others, but there's out there some big thinking going on out there. And recently, in the last week or so, several of the candidates have put up plans to talk about a just transition, a fair transition. And I wanted to just explore that for a minute. And as a sort of a background to that, what I did is I looked up the definition of environmental justice at both the EPA, which is no longer trusted in my, but anyway, EPA, and here in Massachusetts. And what both of those definitions are pretty much the same thing, but it says that environmental justice, as a definition, environmental justice is the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, national origin, or income, with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. Basically, this happens when everyone has the same degree of protection from environmental hazards, that is to say, the refinery in your backyard, and equal access to the decision-making process. That is to say, the hearings are conducted in your own language. Massachusetts says that environmental justice is based on the principle that all people have a right to be protected from environmental pollution and to live in and enjoy a clean and healthful environment. It's the equal protection and meaningful involvement of all people with respect to the development, yada, yada, yada. Equitable distribution of environmental benefits. And I think cases in point we have are kind of, Flint, Michigan, the compressor in Weymouth, the people in Houston who are living next to refineries, stuff like that. All right. So that's the backdrop to talk about environmental justice. Does that make sense, Mariah?
And to sort of toss into the mix a term that I first heard from Van Jones way back, it was like 2006 or something like that. Van Jones threw out this term eco-apartheid, right? Which he sort of, he put four quadrants and kind of talked about how, you have these divisions that can happen with the environmental movement. And actually, I can't remember fully what he had in the four quadrants, but, at the two sort of far ends, he said what you can end up having is an environmental movement where people view environmental issues as specifically only germane to people who drive Priuses and go to yoga and can afford to eat organic food and that and want to save the polar bears. And that is this sort of tower that you have of like, well, it's something that only the wealthy people can afford, right? But then on the flip side, you have the people who are being most affected by burning fossil fuels and polluting the waterways are the ones who are in the sort of the lower income communities or minority communities where you end up getting, they are taking the brunt of it, as you mentioned.
And there was specifically in terms of the sort of the immediate pollution, among other things, the immediate pollution from these infrastructure, wouldn't you say?
Right. Yeah. The impact from that. And I forget where I read it, but I read that very often it actually is those people are the ones who are most concerned and are the most vocal about it, but don't actually get the recognition they deserve for how vocal they are. But they're the ones who are saying, Flint is the sort of the hallmark of like, look, here's the people not taking care of our waterways, and people directly died from it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, you know, I've heard a counterpoint of sort of like, oh, you environmentalists, you have the luxury to care about caring for the environment because you have everything you need. You have your Prius and your organic food. And what about people who are homeless or poor or, you know,
disadvantaged?
Yes, like they don't have time to care about the environment. And that's just completely not true, because they're the ones who are watching their kids die from air pollution or from water. And they are very passionate about environmental issues. And of course, that is one of the motivating factors for me, is that we all deserve an equal right to access to resources that can sustain our life. And yes, the polar bears are important, but I think that the environmental movement got misframed as something that only is concerned about polar bears and driving Priuses and people who have wealth.
Right. There was just as an aside, there was an article, an opinion piece in the New York Times about the fact that, to your point, you know, the women of color are on the front line and have to deal with the health issues and the cleanliness issues and everything in running a household next to these bad places, these refineries, and that they don't get recognized as being fighting that fight and being most directly affected. So to your point, I agree. I mean, it's
go ahead.
I was going to say, well, environmental movement should not sequester itself into this, as you say, silos of white privilege where, you know, you can buy a Prius. I mean, that whole framing is, but I guess to bring it around to the Green New Deal, I mean, the Green New Deal is organized as, I mean, I think organic gets overused, right? But basically, it's this holistic picture of how to address climate change. And central to that is the idea of the involvement of everybody in the discussion. And then that goes to environmental justice issues, to make sure that the people who are driven over, literally, get to have a voice in the process. And it's important to keep that in mind, because oftentimes the Green New Deal is accused of being a Christmas tree onto which every progressive wish list is hung, right? Medicare for all, jobs for everybody, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I think we need to see these as organically connected together. And so it's to that end that I wanted to, let me just say, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has recently introduced a bill into the House, and of course it was with a presidential contender, which is one of several different contenders' proposals, but it is a plan about climate equity, was it? Basically, so Ocasio-Cortez has put into legislation a plan that would force that any environmental regulation would be rated based on its effect on low-income communities. So there's kind of a parallel right now. We have something called the Congressional Budget Office that does a calculation of how much everything's going to cost, right? So if a bill goes through Congress, it has to go through the Congressional Budget Office, get scored. Remember all that talk about scoring different healthcare bills and whatnot for how much they'd cost? Well, this is somewhat parallel in the sense that it would create an official mechanism for looking at the impact on disadvantaged communities of any proposal, whether it be a wind turbine or a fuel infrastructure plan, right? And I think according to the various articles we've talked about, a different presidential contender. So again, we're not shilling for any particular candidate. I mean, but the point being that there are several candidates now that have come out to talk about the inclusion of environmental justice in their plan to address climate change, I think it's a good thing. Well, one of the articles that we'll put up a link to talks about, refer back to your eco-apartheid, basically making the case for the connection between the connection between climate change and housing, right, as this sort of nexus, again, I keep using the word nexus, this, I mean, this connection between where does climate change and housing come together? It's the fact that, in the United States, there are many communities, typically disadvantaged communities, that have energy insecurity. That is to say, something like, I'm looking for the numbers, something like a quarter of the households in the mid-Atlantic. It says, on average, lower-income people pay 25% more for energy per square foot than better-off people. And in the mid-Atlantic, half of black households are energy insecure. That's to say, they've been threatened to have the electricity shut off, right?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And this article,
not
just,
not just threatened. I mean, one, that article, I forget what article it was, but by Daniel Aldana Cohen on July 26th, said that New York utility Con Ed intentionally cut off power to the majority black Canarsie neighborhood to avoid risking broader blackouts.
Yeah.
They intentionally cut off power to this lower income neighborhood so that everyone else could have.
I mean, that's crazy. That's unbelievable. And the fact that it happened is, again, sort of this, all the things come together that's the way the system reacts to put the onus and the unfair burden on the community of color. And that same article goes on to talk about the fact that, providing livable conditions, and this is where you get into air conditioning, efficient energy efficiency. This is a way to reduce energy consumption, a way to provide jobs, and to basically build a consensus, the societal consensus around clean energy. And it goes on to say that this housing issue is sort of specific to the United States, but not really, in the sense that all around the world, there are people in Delhi, in buildings sweating because they don't have air conditioning and dying as the temperatures go through the roof. How are we going to address this on a global level, right, of the connection of where people live? Because where people live, I would imagine, has a huge impact on what their energy footprint is. And so, again, you're saying if you're going to address climate change, it's not just build a bunch of windmills necessarily, right? You have to sort of take on the cultural aspect of the whole thing.
Yeah, and I mean, policies are so important, and that, like you talk, I mean, obviously the Green New Deal is not any sort of a policy, right? It's but the getting things in place, a system in place that protects everyone and gives, everyone the right to clean air and clean water, is so essential. And not to endorse any candidates at all,
right.
But I think that was a big topic that did come up a couple times in the debates on Tuesday. And again, Williamson was talking about the importance of figuring out why our chemical policies and our food policies and agricultural policies and environmental policies are making people sick.
Right.
That's a problem that we need to contend with.
I think what we're seeing is, so we've talked about the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal is a framework. You just said there isn't a specific policy under the Green New Deal, which is absolutely true. But I think what we're seeing is the foundation of the ideas that will go into the various separate pieces of legislation. Because keep in mind, the Green New Deal is equivalent to the original New Deal, the FDR New Deal in the 30s, of which there was no particular bill that said the New Deal on it, right? There was the separate, the Works Progress Administration, the Conservation, all the different bills were under the heading of the Green New Deal. And so here, I mean, of the original New Deal. So here we're building plank by plank the things that would go into a Green New Deal that encompass all of the objectives of the Green New Deal.
And I think to your point, it's the Green New Deal has been thoughtful and very, not forceful is not the right word, but has really been come out strongly for the importance of making sure that it encompasses all aspects, all levels of society in terms of income, and is particularly thoughtful to, again, establishing rights to clean air, clean water, and livable plant climate for everyone, and to make sure that everyone's included in that and we don't have eco-apartheid.
Right. And I think that it's both a moral issue, right, and it's also a pragmatic political issue, because you need to build you need a wide consensus, because case I've made in the past and continue to make is that what we're talking about here is a 100-year kind of program. It's not going to be until the year 2120 that we know if we've succeeded or not, right? And so we need a political coalition that will stay strong. I mean, I can easily imagine we pass aggressive bills and then 10 years later, the bad guys get in charge again and all of a sudden say, well, you know, we don't really need to do this anymore. Everything's great. Look how clean the water is. Carbon pollution is going down. By 2040, you're going to have this pushback against the green new, the clean energy technologies, and you have to build a coalition that's going to persist for many, many years, which is why tangentially pull in the idea of the carbon fee and dividend. I really believe that if people are getting money in their bank account every month from carbon fee revenues, that builds a constituency that will last for decades and decades, right? That doesn't want that to go away. So who knows?
Yeah. I think that's the great power in the framework of the Green New Deal, is it lays out a lot of potential for policies that will address social, economic, and environmental crises at the same time, right? This is like, it's you know, envisioning the world the way we want it to be, right? That's what we're doing here. And so it's not that it's going to be easy, but reimagining the way that we're structured now in ways that solve the environmental crisis while lifting up lower income communities, it's a no-brainer.
Right. Yeah.
Right? Why don't we want a community why don't we want to live on a planet where there's far less pollution? There was a poor air quality advisement yesterday. If you're elderly or sick, you were on Tuesday. If you're elderly or sick, you were told not to go outdoors and breathe the air in Boston.
Right.
Boston, right? Our like fair city of Boston that I sort
the
of
sitting on
like,
a hill.
Oh. It's you know, no, nothing's gonna hurt Boston. Maybe sea level rise, you know. But you weren't supposed to go outside yesterday because of the air quality in Boston. Like you expect
home.
That from you know. Los Angeles or, you know, in India, there's a lot of places, right?
Right.
But not Boston, but nope, we're all
in the same boat here, I think.
We're all in the same boat and you can't, air travels. I mean, you can't get away from air, so.
Right. Well, that's a good, the vision of the future that we're building as opposed to the fear we're running away from, we want to build a future that we want, and that's, we're doing that bit by bit. Well, there you go, Mariah. We'll put up links to some of the stuff that we talked about. That's, of course, at the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. And you can find this show on our Facebook page, plus a bunch of other interesting stuff at the Facebook page at /massclimateaction. You can listen to this show on almost any of the major podcast distribution applications on your cell phone in this modern age. You can send us a note to... an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. We appreciate it, and we incorporate those things in our show. So we'll close the way we always close. Oh, I want to thank DR. Thank our friend DR for his continuing.
Yay, DR!
Yay, DR. It's always the underpinning of what we think about each week. So thanks, DR, for your continuing research support. We want to close by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must let the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan, using regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So, Mariah, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.